Welcome back to the It's On Us Clemson University podcast. My name is Abigail Anthes, and today we're going to be talking with Hannah Feltz. Hannah is a licensed nurse and has worked as a forensic nurse for several years and as a forensic nurse coordinator for a children's advocacy center. Hannah is incredibly passionate about helping survivors, and we are so thankful for her being a part of the podcast. We do want to include a trigger warning for this episode, as we will be discussing sexual assault and sexual assault examinations. This episode is intended to provide an understanding about what a forensic or SANE nurse, which stands for sexual assault nurse examinator, is, their training, and the procedures they go through during a sexual assault examination, in the hopes of providing survivors as much information as possible so they can make the best decision for themselves. We also hope that this conversation is encouraging to those listening and reminds you that you are seen, you are believed, and you are not alone. If you would like more information or to get connected with It's On Us, follow us on our Instagram at It's On Us CU. Without further ado, let's hop right into the episode. Hi, so welcome to the podcast. Would you mind starting out by just introducing yourself, telling us a little bit about your background, where you're from, where you got your degree and your license, and yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. My name's Hannah Feltz. I am currently living in Tyler, Texas. I'm from the Dallas area originally, but I've been here for quite a while, about a decade now. Yeah, I went to school at UT Tyler, and that's actually where I finished my first degree in kinesiology. So I'm a bachelor's in kines, and then I was doing my internship and was working at a facility that had a nurse there and an exercise physiologist that I was actually really learning from. And I kind of was watching the nurse and thought, man, what she's doing, I think is really what I want to be doing. I love studying the exercise and nutrition and all of that, but just the role that a nurse can play in getting to be with somebody in the worst times of their life. There's nothing that makes me more honored than to get to walk through difficult times with them, especially in those vulnerable moments that they have, to be able to give them control back and to give them choices and to be able to walk them through difficult circumstances. And so I redirected into getting a bachelor's in nursing and then worked in trauma intensive care here at UT Health, used to be ETMC, but I worked there for about 5 years. And then I travel nursed into Arizona, actually. So worked with an agency and did ICUs there and worked at a level one trauma center there as well. And then I started in forensic nursing and studying in that in 2018 and became a sexual assault nurse examiner, I think it was in 2019, and began working at UT Health in the ER on call for sexual assault exams. And then I became the forensic nurse coordinator for the Children's Advocacy Center and worked there for about 2 years. And then just recently, I started kind of taking a break from forensic nursing just for my own health and wellness. And so I started working in a functional medicine clinic in the meantime, but do plan on going back into forensic nursing.
Wow, that is so incredible and just admirable. The fact that that is your purpose and just your desire to help people, that is so special. And I can't wait to hear more about your experiences and your wisdom. And yeah, I'm just excited to hear more from you about all of that. But it's actually really cool how we got connected through your experience and teaching in Krav Maga and self-defense. So I would love to hear more about that and just why you care about it and how you got involved and a little more about that.
Yeah, I'd love to. So I actually, this is in 2010, when I was an athlete at one point in time. And when I was in college, I had stopped playing sports and was really wanting to continue to do something active. But on top of that, I had a circumstance that kind of made me realize that I just really wanted to learn more about what if I was faced with a circumstance, how can I prepare myself best? What most college girls think of. Granted, it's so much more complex than what I realized when I was thinking, oh man, I don't really know how I would address these situations that I have heard of people facing and face myself. And so I found Krav Maga. Actually, a guy I was working with had gone to Israel and told me about Krav Maga because he was like, this sounds exactly like what you're looking for. Because I told him, like, I don't want to do I don't want to just do a sport. Like, I want to do something that's active. So I don't want to sit in a classroom and learn, you know, about self-defense, but I also don't want to just do a sport. So I don't want to be competing in this. This is something that I want to utilize for just my daily life. And so he told me about Israeli hand-to-hand combat, which is what Krav Maga is. And everyone in Israel has to go in the military, right? And so it doesn't matter if you're fast, slow, overweight, underweight, female, male, you have to go in the military for a couple of years. And this is the system that they use for their military. And then the U.S. adapted it and used it here in the U.S. as well. And so it works for everybody, whether you're female or male, or whether you're small or tall, or, you know, whatever your skills are, it works for just the daily life. So, yeah, so I started doing that. And that's, you know, I learned more about spiritual and mental warfare, we'll call it, than I did about the physical. And a lot of the principles that applied with physical situations really applied to my heart and my mind and things that I was facing in college. Mm. And so it really changed the way that I viewed a lot of things and the way that I faced a lot of circumstances, whether it be depression, anxiety, fear. And I struggled a lot with depression and a lot of what women and just anybody, any human can deal with, of just about in your mind. Really learned a lot of tools to be able to recognize those things and to be able to address them and fight them in a healthy way. So yeah, so that's how I ended up. And then I became an instructor and started teaching just level one and really, really loved it.
Yeah, that is so cool. I was really just so blessed to experience this and to not only learn it myself, but to witness young women just become so empowered and confident through that training. And like you said, I think it's so cool that such a physical thing can be also so spiritual and mental and healing in those ways, which are just as important, if not more, and so prevalent in so many people's lives. And so I think it's really cool and special to be able to learn something that can be so applicable and so helpful in just anxiety and fear and depression, just giving us tools to be able to combat those things.
Yeah, I went into forensic nursing. I got pretty nervous about teaching self-defense because a lot of those forensic nurses really helped me see the limits of self-defense because it doesn't work for all circumstances.
Right. Yes.
Especially when you're talking about an innocent child, or even it doesn't matter what you're wearing or what party you were at. It is never okay for someone to do anything to you that
right.
you consent to. And so sometimes in the self-defense world, they end up victim blaming even, but by putting the focus back on the victim and what they should have done differently, or, you know, to have avoided something that sometimes is not avoidable, unfortunately.
Right.
And no matter how much self-defense training you may have, oftentimes it's not going to necessarily help you in those circumstances. It can, and there can be some benefit to that. But what I realized again was just that, like you said, the empowerment, the excitement, putting control back into a survivor and equipping them in that they are not a victim. They're a survivor, right?
Right.
In that way, and equip them for the future, make them feel empowered. And again, yeah, just put that control back in their hands, because unfortunately, perpetrators are likely not going to go anywhere, right? I mean, we're not going to stop doing these criminal acts of violence against other people. And so we do want to put the focus on prosecuting them and on stopping that. But we also want to put the focus and the just empowerment back into the survivors' hands.
Yeah, I think that's so important to bring up, just the idea that we are not here to victim blame whatsoever, and that self-defense, that is not the purpose of it. It is not to say, oh, well, if you had just known this or had these skills, maybe this wouldn't have happened. That is not the purpose at all, but rather, like you said, to just put control back into the survivor's hands. And I just love that. That is something that Krav Maga can do. But yeah, moving on a little bit more into your day-to-day experience just as a SANE nurse, or is saying SANE nurse examiner, I guess that is, it says nurse examiner in it. What is like the proper title to specify when referring to it?
So a lot of people, what we used to be called all the time is just SANE nurses, which
yeah,
about, because that sometimes is appropriate because we're a little wacky. But it's S-A-N-E. It just stands for sexual assault nurse examiner.
Right.
That is the umbrella term for that would be forensic nursing. So there's a lot of different things that can be in, you know, under the umbrella of forensic nursing, and sexual assault nurse examiner is one of those things. A sexual assault nurse examiner encompasses more than what that same title gives off the impression of. And so a lot of times we'll refer to ourselves as forensic nurses because we're doing more than, again, what a sexual assault nurse examiner, because we'll see strangulation, we'll see abuse, we'll see domestic violence.
Yeah.
And so we do prefer to be called forensic nurses for that reason, to kind of help understand that it's not just a tunneled.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Awesome. Okay. I didn't know that. That's great. Yeah. Okay. So what for just a better understanding for survivors of what this process looks like, whatever they're coming in for, that falls under all the things you just mentioned. What, from the moment a survivor comes into the ER or the hospital, what does that process look like of checking in and questioning and maybe paperwork? Who would they see? What does that look like before the actual examination?
Let me give a caveat that what the goal is for it to look like may not be what it looked like for someone that has been through it. And so just give this caveat that if I explain the way that our goal in the practice that I've had, and if that's not been your experience as a listener, I'm so sorry. And this is not to take away from the experience that you've had, but we are ever growing. And so there are a lot of survivors that have told us their story, and we have done things that could be greatly improved upon. And I think we've come a long way and improved a lot. So I've talked to some people that have been through it, you know, maybe 10 years ago, and their experience was gravely different than hopefully what I'll describe. But also the context is important. And so kind of depends on the circumstances surrounding that as to how the everything can play out and in what order it will play out. So it can look greatly different than, it's not really a cookie cutter. And it depends on kind of the area that you're in. So obviously state by state laws are different, so things function differently, but also even just region by region or county to county, and same nurse to same nurse and law enforcement to law enforcement, it can look a little bit different. So here in this area, if a law enforcement report has been made, sometimes law enforcement will reach out to a forensic nurse directly, or will reach out to the hospital, kind of figure out where the best place is for that survivor to go. Sometimes if it's a pediatric, where I was the coordinator at the Children's Advocacy Center, oftentimes we would connect them there so that they didn't need to be in the ER. But if they needed ER care, then we would obviously connect them to a forensic nurse in the ER. So if a law enforcement report has not been made yet and someone just walks into the ER, you know, something has happened and they need medical care and they are trying to look for the next steps to do, they'll be triaged like a lot of people will, or every ER patient will be. The goal would be, right, for the triage nurse not to gather details of anything. They're just going to ask, what brought you in? They're going to say, sexual assault, or I was hurt, or, you know, whatever the description is, that's enough for them to know, okay, we need a forensic nurse. And they will put them in a room and they'll call the forensic nurse that's on call to come in.
Okay.
If they report to law enforcement, so, which we're going to get to this, but between the ages of 18 and 65, you can have a non-reporting sexual assault exam. So if the survivor doesn't want to speak to law enforcement, doesn't want to report to law enforcement, they don't have to. So in that instance, they would come in, they'd call the forensic nurse, we would do a non-reporting exam, and we could talk more about what the details of that look like in a little bit, and we would proceed that direction. If they are, you know, younger than 18, if they're a child, or if they are over 65, it's not an option to report to law enforcement, it has to be reported to law enforcement. In that instance, patrol often will come out to the hospital. And they will have to gather, again, the goal would be minimal information, enough to know that they need a sexual assault exam. And that can encompass a few different things, but to know that there's evidence collection that needs to happen and a forensic nurse needs to be there. When they have that conversation, they get just the very basic information to know that, then they step out and they hand it over to the forensic nurse. And then we'll start the process on with that.
So even for whether the police are there because of the age ranges you gave, or because there has been a report made or the survivor asks for the police to be there, you said that they'll only be there for preliminary information, limited information, and then they would be leaving. They wouldn't be there for the examination or anything after that.
Correct. Again, there are going to be circumstances where education is needed for law enforcement, or circumstances might vary if there's a safety concern.
Right.
There's some differences, but they do not need to be there for that exam. Sometimes it's someone from a prison or something, then they would have to have a security officer there or something like that, but not otherwise. They just get enough information to know that a sexual assault exam is needed or a sexual assault exam is not needed. And then they bow out. And the rest of that comes into play after the survivors received the medical care and evidence collection that they need. That takes precedence on the earlier part of that.
So moving on into the actual examination process, after all of those things that you walked us through, I know that is very dependent on what survivor is coming in for and their specific case, but as best you can, like a general explanation of how that works. And I think also just a little bit about the reasoning behind those steps, because I think for probably a lot of forensic nurses, they don't necessarily have time to walk through the reasonings behind every single thing that's happening, which it makes sense. But I think that's a really cool thing about just being able to hear from you, that hopefully survivors can understand more what those steps look like and why they're happening, so that they can feel more in control and understanding of if they want that and why that would be important.
Yeah. I hate the fact that you said that we oftentimes don't have time. And I do want to speak to that real quick, because that should never be the case. And I'm so sorry for anybody that has experienced that, where the nurse hasn't taken the time to explain the why, because the very first step of this process is to explain the options and to explain the why. Sometimes it can be a lot, and that can be really, really hard for a survivor that's in trauma brain to be able to process all of that. And so it's important for the forensic nurse to be patient, to repeat, sometimes to make follow-up calls again, because it can be really hard to remember all the vast amount of information. But we typically only have one patient, and that's the survivor. And that's what's beautiful about a forensic nurse, is we come in for that one patient, and that one patient only, and they are also our sole focus until everything that they need is completed. So that being said, the first thing when we come in is we figure out who is with this survivor, and if they are all due and legally able to have an advocate with them. And so we immediately get them a support person if they want to have, you know, if they decline a support person, that's okay, because it's totally their choice. But we do offer that. We offer for them to have an advocate with them that can give them information and help them. Again, like we were talking about, with the vast amount of information and needs sometimes that survivors have, it's going to take, it's not just a one day or a 6 hour endeavor. It's right. It's going to be a process. And so that advocate can be very helpful in connecting them after they leave the hospital.
Would that advocate be someone through the hospital that you're talking about, or the police, or is that just like a family friend or someone who's there with them?
So here in this area, we have the East Texas Crisis Center, and they have trained advocates. They're volunteers, but they are trained, very well-trained advocates for survivors of sexual assault, domestic violence, child abuse, all of those things.
Right.
They are who respond. They're on call, and they'll respond to the hospital. We don't have any employees that are advocates. There are other nonprofits or other organizations that also have advocates that are trained in responding to those circumstances. There's more than just, you know, that one crisis center that we can pull advocates from. When it comes to family, friends, whoever they want in the room with them, yeah, can be in the room with them.
Okay.
There is one exception to that, and that's when we talk to them about what happened.
Okay.
And I say that's an exception. All in all, that's their decision. But we try to encourage for there to be some privacy with that, because we don't necessarily know the impact that whoever's there with them can have on what they feel comfortable saying or not saying. But if they do want that person to stay in there with them, they can. That's not to say that they can't stay in there with them. But we do try to reduce the amount of people in the room for us to be able to talk to them about what happened, reduce any impact that can have on what they share. But they can have an advocate and they can have their best friend or their mom or their dad or whoever other supportive person that they would like to have with them. Yeah. Sometimes survivors will want to talk to the advocate on the front end, but then they'll want them to leave. And that's okay too. If they request for them not to be in the room, they can also be on standby. You know, they can hang out in the hospital, but not be in the room with them in case they want them at some point. So all of that's up to the survivor.
Okay. Awesome. So moving on into the actual examination process, knowing that this might not be exactly what happens everywhere, but also overall idea of that.
Yeah. So we'll talk through, this is kind of a personal preference, and what I was trained in was to kind of talk through even the end of the exam and what that looks like, but at the front end. So talking through one, all of the options that they have when it comes to if there's pregnancy concerns or possibility of pregnancy, we can talk through that. We can talk through STI prophylaxis, preventing sexually transmitted diseases. We can talk about HIV prophylaxis and all of those options that they have on the front end before we get kind of deep into it. That way they can hopefully remember and have a little bit more of an ability to process through some of those decisions as time goes.
Right.
But we also talk about where are we going from here? So do you have someone with you, a safe person, or you're going to go to a safe place? Is, you know, whoever did this to you, do we know where they're at? Are they still violent? Are they potentially going to be coming to the hospital? How do we keep you safe? And where are you going from here? Do you have a safe place to go and someone to get you there?
Right.
We process through that at the front end. We sign consents, and that includes informed consent, right? So that takes some time because I'm going to explain through what each of those things mean and give them the option of all of it. It's like a buffet. They can pick what they are comfortable with and they can change their mind too. So we say this is consent to start, but if you change your mind throughout this examination process, you can absolutely change your mind and withdraw your consent at any point. So we'll go through that. And then we'll take a history, and that's for the purposes of medical diagnosis and treatment. So essentially, we just talk to them about what happened. We don't ask leading questions, so we don't lead them to an answer. We ask very broad, which can be sometimes frustrating for a survivor because they're like, what do you mean by that question? It is very broad questions because we do not want to put words in their mouth, lead them to say anything that is not what is coming straight out of their mouth, and we don't want to interpret anything. So we ask a lot of clarifying questions so that we make sure that we're not assuming anything.
Right.
And so again, that can take a brief amount of time, or that can take a really long time, because sometimes this is something that isn't just a one day thing. This could have been going on for a long period of time. And so there might be more than one circumstance that we need to talk about. So that can take a good bit of time. After we gather the history, that way we kind of know what we need to do to make sure that this person is okay and safe, and what treatments or options that we have for them. We'll do a head to toe, which is just what it sounds like, just like a regular doctor's visit. We're just going to look from head to toe. Sometimes, again, if this is consented to, we will take photos of injuries and we'll have a little ruler as well. And so we'll take a few different pictures from a few different angles, some with the ruler, some without. And we'll measure, you know, each injury on the body. A physician comes in and sees that patient as well. And this can be, you know, oftentimes it's going to be at the very beginning. So I missed that part. A physician's going to come in and make sure that there's not any immediate medical emergency that needs to be dealt on the front end. But as soon as we can clear them to eat, we're going to get them food as well. Make sure that they get something in their belly. So after the head to toe, we'll do an anogenital exam. It's just, again, if it's consented to, and whomever they want in the room with them will be with them. And a part of that, we will collect evidence. So if we do a sexual assault kit, it's going to have a bunch of little Q-tips in it. And throughout this process, we'll be just using a little Q-tip. Anything that's dry, we wet the Q-tip and swab. Anything that's wet, we leave the Q-tip dry and we swab. And oftentimes I'll show the patient what the Q-tip looks like. And if it's, you know, something that they can reach and they want to do it themselves, they can swab themselves. And so anywhere on the body that there might be any sort of evidence, we will collect that. We'll sometimes collect clothes as well. Again, if the patient's okay with it, we'll collect clothes and underwear and all that kind of stuff. And if this is something that could have been going on for a while, then we might check for sexually transmitted diseases. If it happened today, oftentimes we won't collect any sexually transmitted diseases because that's not going to show what happened from today, because sexually transmitted diseases won't show up until a few weeks out or longer.
Right.
And so we will oftentimes in adults, especially if they're sexually active normally, if they were assaulted, we may not collect that day. We'll do prophylactic treatment. So we'll give them antibiotics that can prevent them from getting any sexually transmitted diseases from that situation. We'll talk about the risk factors for HIV and talk about, you know, if they're a candidate for that and if that's something that they would like to do and if that's something that they're able to do as well. We're going to collect any evidence that's on their body that we can collect. We're going to try to collect all that. That's a part of the sexual assault kit. And then when we finish all the exam, then we will do discharge instructions. We'll do some, you know, education. We can talk through any questions, concerns, which we're going to do all throughout the exam. But any fears or questions or concerns that survivor has, we're going to process through all of those things and give them some written and verbal education and talk about follow-up care. So especially when something acute happens, it's really important to follow up with a couple of weeks. And depending on what injuries they had and what medications they took, if they, you know, start on the HIV prophylaxis, that can be really hard on the body. So they need to follow up with a physician within a couple, you know, typically a week or two out, actually a week after if they've started the HIV prophylaxis, just to make sure that their body's handling it okay. And so we'll talk about where they want to follow up and how they want to follow up and what means they have and what physician they can see and make sure that we get them connected with that as well. We'll also give them a little card. It's got the tracking information. So I think it was September of, 19 or 20, legislature came out and they started this tracking program for the sexual assault kits. And so the survivor gets a little card and that has the information that they need in order to be able to track the kit that they had collected. Doesn't tell them results or anything like that, but it'll tell them where it's at in the process of, you know, pick up from the hospital to law enforcement, to the crime lab and back to law enforcement. We'll give them information on that and explain all of that to them as well.
Awesome. Is that a Texas legislature or do you know if that's a broader thing that more states have as well?
That is a great question. I don't know the answer to that. I can down and get back with you. I mean, I know it's Texas. I don't know if it's federal.
That's interesting. That's really cool. I had never heard of that.
Okay. I think I'm actually looking at the website right now. Yeah, it's called Track Kit for Sexual Assault Kits, and it does look like it is multi-state and federal. This website is actually really interesting. I think it would be worth looking into. It's called STACSDNA.com, Sample Tracking and Control Solutions. And this company looks like they created this thing called Track Kit that is now used federally for survivors to be able to see where their kits are in the process.
It's cool because it just helps with accountability too and making sure, you know, the kits get where they need to go. Time that they need to get there. So
yeah, speaking of that whole process, so after a kit is taken and the examination is done, so for the specific instance of the 18 to 65 range, if a survivor comes in and they do not want the police involved, at least at that time, and there hasn't been a police report made, what happens to that kit if they still want that for maybe the future, if they decide to report eventually? How is there a timeline of how long the hospital will keep it? Yeah, just what does that look like?
Yeah, that's called a non-reporting sexual assault exam. It's great because it gives a survivor 5 years to decide if they want to report that to law enforcement or not. Because sometimes in the moment with all of this going on, they need medical care, they want to get all the things done, but they want to think through what it's going to look like to report to law enforcement, and they may not feel comfortable with that at that time. So it allows them to make sure and get all the medical care that they need and evidence collection. And again, give them time to think of that. So when we collect it, we send it to the DPS warehouse and they keep it for up to 5 years. After 5 years, then it'll be destroyed if that is not reported in that time. Okay. The survivor decides to report, they will pull it and process it. And yeah, and it's really, a lot of people don't know that that's an option. They think, me to be able to get help, like I'm gonna have to go, you know, make a law enforcement report.
Right.
And again, that's just for those adult ages.
Yes.
65. Yeah.
So what's the DPS office? You said that's where it's stored. What is that?
DPS warehouse.
Mm-hmm.
I've never been there. That's okay. A good question. But I mean, I believe it's just a warehouse through DPS.
Is DPS, is that a Department of
Public Safety?
Public safety. Okay. Interesting. And then I guess also, and I know that we kind of discussed this in terms of if a survivor is coming in for something that was that day in a one-time occurrence, or if this has been an ongoing trauma or abuse, it would definitely affect this. But is there a timeline of getting an exam and kit taken that a survivor can come in for that in terms of like how long after abuse or trauma? What does that look like?
Yeah, there is. So this does also depend on where you're at, like counties and states. And so here in Smith County, it's 120 hours to get an acute sexual assault exam.
Okay.
Outside of that window, just evidence isn't going to be there. And so it's not that the survivor doesn't need medical care, because they do. And so it's not this is not saying that they shouldn't go to the hospital or they shouldn't seek medical care, because there's a lot of things that we can still do outside of 5 days for the health and wellness of and healing of that survivor. The thing that we wouldn't be able to do would be the evidence collection. Because evidence just doesn't last that long, especially, you know, when you've showered and bathed and brushed your teeth and eaten and, you know, changed your clothes and washed your clothes or thrown your clothes away, you know, those types of things, that evidence is lost over time. And so outside of 5 days, the research shows that there's just not the evidence there to be able to collect.
Okay.
Now with children, different. So with children, there is such a thing as a non-acute medical forensic exam, because we know that the circumstances are just different with children. So sometimes we may find out that abuse has been happening with a child and we may not find out within the 5 days. And again, we wouldn't be able to do evidence collection when it comes to the sexual assault kit, but there is other evidence that can be seen and collected, so to say, in a non-acute medical forensic exam of a child. And so whether that be a sexually transmitted disease that's diagnostic of sexual abuse, or, you know, other findings that can be consistent, it's still important for that child to get that medical care, whether or not there is evidence to be found or not, because again, the child's not going to go to a gynecologist. There are pediatric gynecologists out there, but by and large, that situation, that child needs some specialized medical care. And typically that's going to be a forensic nurse that's going to be well equipped to be able to provide that care for them. And so we'll offer them a medical forensic exam.
So is a non-acute examination, is that only for children, or are there non-acute exams for adults as well?
Yeah, so a non-acute exam for an adult would just be going to their gynecologist or a physician, you know, getting an exam.
Okay.
And that can be hard, because sometimes, you know, we hope that all physicians would be trauma-informed, and they may. And so that is a barrier, and that is really hard, but that is not something that is offered for adults that I am aware of.
Okay.
The children, and you know, those non-acute exams, those are still requested by law enforcement. So that's something that law enforcement decides if that is a, you know, something that would be pertinent to that child in a non-acute exam.
So you mentioned, I guess, the idea of a physician being trauma-informed. As a forensic examiner, what does that training look like for mental health and trauma awareness? Who gives that to you? Like, what is a part of that license or just training in general?
I don't know, like, as a whole in the medical community of different places that can provide that. That would be a great question that I would love to find out and I need to do research on. But when it comes to the forensic nursing community, that's a big piece of what we do, right? Because everything that we see is trauma, and every survivor responds differently and it can have a different impact and a huge impact. So a part of our training in forensic nursing, we do discuss a lot of the impact of trauma on children and adults and how to provide trauma-informed care. We also just do a lot of continuing education that's required to recertify, and a lot of forensic nurses are a part of the International Association of Forensic Nurses, and there's a lot of training that's provided through them. And that's where I've gotten a lot of training. We've studied, you know, a lot of, I don't know if you've heard of adverse childhood experiences, but there's studies about the ACEs studies that show correlations between trauma in childhood and even cardiovascular disease, diabetes, different disease processes, as well as high-risk behaviors, you know, of infections and pregnancy, mental health, you know, all of those types of things. It is so important with survivors of abuse to be able to have someone that supports them and believes them in the process, provide them with support and to hopefully prevent some of those things from becoming an issue for them.
Yeah.
I answered your question, but
no, yeah. Yes. I also wanted to just ask in terms of you personally and just your experience, your years doing this and being a forensic nurse and obviously experiencing and witnessing a lot of secondhand trauma, what that has been like in terms of your own personal mental health and how even someone listening who might not be a survivor, but an ally, if you have any experience or tips in terms of walking alongside someone who's going through that, or even being an advocate or being someone in the room during a forensic exam, things like that. Yeah, that was a broad question, but.
I got the pleasure of working with some very experienced forensic nurses that really advocated to require counseling of forensic nurses.
Yeah.
I hope that that even transitions into, you know, nursing in general, because I struggled with vicarious trauma when I was in ICU and dealing with a lot of the things that I saw there. Because part of being a caring person that wants to come alongside somebody and help them in the process of one of the worst days of their life.
Yeah.
Someone that is good at that and desires to do that is typically going to be a really empathetic person.
Right.
And part of that is I had to learn how to feel what my patients were feeling to the best way that I knew how to feel what they were feeling, because I never can.
Right.
But every, you know, survivor story is so different. But to the best of my ability, I would try to truly be with them in the suffering that they were in.
Yeah.
And that's going to impact you.
Yeah.
And that is going to change you, and hopefully in a good way. And I know it has me. It's changed a lot of the way I view things and approach and the way I view the world. But in order to prevent that from being something that hinders you in your practice or ability to think critically or to be able to process the circumstances to do the best for that patient, or prevent you from being able to function in society in a healthy way. In order to do that, you have to have a lot of things in place in your own life in order to know where your struggles are, where your weaknesses are, where you might need some help and be willing to get that help.
Yeah.
So from the time I started, you know, I had a lot of those things in place where I kind of knew what provided anxiety relief for me or how I best processed some of the things that I've seen that I can't talk about. And a lot of, for me, is journaling, is reading scripture, is praying, because I can talk to the Lord about every patient, every circumstance I've seen without worrying about HIPAA. So processing that with him, with spending time with my dogs, you know, my dogs just bring me a lot of joy, and seeing a counselor that's trained in vicarious trauma and in helping first responders deal with stuff like that. Those are the things that I kind of had in place from starting in practice. And those are the things I would encourage. It's going to look different for, you know, for every person and what is best for them when handling those things. But, and to know when it's time to take a break. I know that that's something that I struggled with, was just feeling like a failure. I needed to step away. Mm. And if I knew that that was going to be best for my patients.
Yeah.
Because I want them to have 100% of whatever nurse can be there for them. And if that can't be me right now, then it's going to be someone else that can. I can be at my best, then I can, you know, continue to be there for them. And so that's the other encouragement is, not to blame and shame or, you know, all those things for yourself either.
Right, right.
Keeping your temperature, knowing where you're at, knowing where your limits are, knowing kind of where your signs and symptoms are of burnout or of, again, vicarious trauma, because it can be hard to realize in yourself. Other people might be able to realize it, but it can be really hard to identify in yourself. And so having some people around you, some family that knows how to approach you if they can tell that you're struggling, and not be afraid to have difficult conversations, because we need people around us as well supporting and encouraging us to take care of ourselves. So,
yeah, I think that's a whole nother really important conversation, especially when it comes to being an ally or working in a field like this, but just in general, being a human, that we put so much pressure on ourselves if we're in these kind of situations where we're helping others. And like you said, those things can be heavy, and sometimes not feeling like, oh, I'm a failure or I'm not showing up for people in this way, but also knowing that that important level and understanding of yourself when you need to seek help for yourself and put yourself first, and knowing that ultimately helping that person best is going to be you at your healthiest and prioritizing your own mental health and wellness. And so if that's not where you are, understanding that there can be other people that will show up for that person in those capacities. But yeah, just the importance of that and allowing yourself the freedom to know when you need to put up boundaries and yeah, whatever that looks like in a professional sense, but also relational sense for allies to survivors and survivors being an ally to another survivor, things like that. I think, yeah, that's a really important point. And I'm really thankful you brought it up and shared that.
All of what you just said, you said it so beautifully. And boundaries are not fun. They're not fun at all. And yeah, they are super, super important. And they're not prevalent. It's almost, it feels like it's looked down upon. Like,
yeah,
kind of set a boundary. It feels like you are, yeah, letting someone down or like you're weak or, you know, especially when it comes to someone that is surviving something like
that. Right.
And I think that that is, again, I've worked for some very well-experienced forensic nurses in leadership that have done a beautiful job of trying to kind of change that trajectory a little bit. And you can tell a difference in the patients and in the care that they receive too. We're
trying
to take care of ourselves.
Yeah.
And prioritize that.
Yeah.
It's hard to.
Yeah. That idea that boundaries can sometimes seem like something that is almost confrontational or something where you're letting someone down. But yeah, I think like you said it so well, just knowing how to take care of yourself is not something that is letting someone down, and just the importance of being well equipped personally so that you can help others. I think, yeah, that's really important. I think that's really most of the questions that I have. I'd love to thank you so much for being here and all of your wisdom and just sharing all this information. But is there anything else that you would like a survivor or ally listening to know, or just really any last thoughts that you'd have that you'd like to share?
Yeah, any survivor that's listening, I don't know how to say this, but I don't think there is a bigger honor than getting to walk alongside someone that is so strong and courageous as to walk that. And I have heard the struggle that is of shame and confusion and fear and all of the things that come with that. So I would imagine it is not easy to try to walk into a hospital to get care, to talk to somebody. But I want you to know that the people that have been hearing your story, one, believe you, one, want to be there with you, to walk alongside you with that, and three, thank the world of you and your strength and your courage to walk out of that. So yeah, that's what I can think of. I'm so, so thankful to get to, I've just loved your podcast. I think I saw earlier, but just the work that you guys are doing, I it's so fun and such a blessing to see y'all do it. It's needed. And I hope that it continues to spread in many other places. So
yeah, thank you so much, Hannah.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode. We hope it was informative as well as encouraging and a reminder that you are not alone and you are believed. If you would like to learn more or get involved, feel free to reach out and follow us on our Instagram @itsonuscu.